You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 60 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, so things like moves and combos and choreographies, there are a lot of resources available. But if you want help with the why and the how, so things like musicality, composition, culture, business, ethics, all of that stuff is a little bit harder to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for question and answer so that you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Kay Hardy Campbell. She's had a lifelong fascination for the culture of Saudi Arabia and its Gulf neighbors. She learned the women's dances while living in Saudi Arabia and teaches those dances around the U.S. at workshops. Kay also writes articles for publications like Aramco World Magazine as she continues to research and write about music and dance of the Arabian Peninsula. She also plays the oud and violin and helps direct the Arabic Music Retreat. You can check out her website at kayhardycampbell.com. Or if you want to hear more from her, you can also listen to Clubhouse episode 35, which was her first appearance on the show, talking about Khaliji dance. So welcome back to the show, Kay.
Oh, thanks so much, Nadira. Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm really happy to have you. So everybody, Kay is going to talk about her experiences in Saudi Arabia, her observations on women and culture there, and how all of this came together to inspire her new novel, A Caravan of Brides. Now, you do not need to have listened to the, have read the book before listening. And we are going to be careful to avoid spoilers or at a minimum warn you when they're coming. But I do highly recommend it. It is a beautiful book with a lovely story.
Thank you.
All right. So, Kay, before we jump in, why don't you tell us your origin story? Can you tell us about how you got started in music and dance and how your connection to Saudi Arabia began?
Well, I was born into a musical family, and we were all expected to play an instrument. So my first thing was playing piano about the age of five, violin, cello, French horn, choir, guitar, et cetera, et cetera. But I became very fascinated with the Arab world when I was about 15, when they reran the movie Lawrence of Arabia in the movie theaters. And I saw that movie, and I think it was the soundtrack that got to me. It changed my life, and I decided I wanted to study Arabic. And I know that's very corny. I used to never admit that until I heard that Steven Spielberg decided to become a director because of that movie. So I figured if he can admit to being inspired by it, so can I. And I went on to study Arabic in college. And while I was there, I got introduced to the music. And people were teaching belly dance at the University of Minnesota where I was studying. So I took belly dance classes. But I really learned my first infusion of Arabic music when I was studying Tunisia in Arabic in Tunisia one summer. And they took us on a little trip outside the city, a break from our studies, and they hired a folkloric band to follow our bus of students around. And every night they would play for us and they'd get us up dancing. So I just went crazy for Tunisian folklore and the folk dances of Tunisia. And that really, I remember I came back with a few little 45s that I just played into the ground. And I always was fascinated with Arabia. And just as an undergraduate, before I'd visited Saudi Arabia, I tried to do research on Bedouin music and I found you could find nothing. This is a long time ago. No recordings. There were only a few mentions in, some of the European travelers who were not musicians, so they really didn't know how to describe it. When my husband and I graduated from college, we went off to Saudi Arabia, and when I was over there, I began to write for the Arab News, which is an English language daily paper. And because I could read, write, and speak Arabic, they gave me pretty much the leeway to write any story I wanted. And I was so curious about the folk culture, all aspects of it, from jewelry to costume to language to, you know, dance and music, that it was like I had a free rein to do anthropological and cultural research. So that's what I did, and I started writing that way. And I interviewed people just to learn anything I could, because it really wasn't in evidence before me. You know, the women's side of things was still a little bit hidden. But then I made friends and was invited into people's homes, and I got to go to weddings to actually see it. Long answer. I hope that helps.
Oh, no, it's perfect. And for this show, that is like very medium length. So you can always ramble if you want. Usually when people tell me they're worried they're rambling, that's when they're getting to the good stuff. So
okay.
All right. Well, can you also introduce us to your book? If somebody had never heard of your book, what would you want them to know about it?
Well, it's a story set in the world of Saudi women, and it's a story about an unlikely friendship between a troubled college graduate and a mysterious older woman storyteller. And they each tell their life stories to each other, and in so doing, they give each other the courage to go on and do what they have to do. But in the process, they also reveal how it was to be a woman 100 years ago and 40 years ago and everywhere in between, and so many stories of intrigue, love, adventure, etc. That's what about.
Now, we know from your origin story that you're an author, and just looking at your bio page, I can see that you've written a ton, but this is your first novel, right?
Yes, this is my first novel, right.
All right, and what inspired you to write this?
Well, my time in Arabia, obviously, I mean, when I came back, when you come back from living overseas, it's really sometimes hard to readjust. And one thing I did was write down all these little anecdotes and short stories about things that had happened to me and my husband, funny adventures that we had, and things that always struck me as really interesting. And then I started thinking, well, why don't I take some of these ideas and what if this and what if that, and I started to craft a novel, which was really a novelette. You know, when I say this is my first novel, it's about the third complete rewrite, so it's really almost my second or third novel. but it began to take shape, and it took many different forms. The early versions had an American protagonist, and I did all kinds of no-nos that first-time authors do. Like, you start it with a dream sequence, which is absolutely... Nobody does that. It's not proper. But that's how you start out learning, you know. You write what you want to write. And eventually I worked it into this format. After 9/11, which really so badly threw me for a loop, I took out the American protagonist, and I decided I really wanted to tell the earlier history of Arabia for many, many reasons. But it just seemed like it was almost an urgent mission that I wanted to do that. And so I really developed the story of the older woman, Selma, at that time.
All right. So this process was going on for quite a long time.
Yes. Yeah. Some of my friends have read versions that were written in the early 90s, then the late 90s, and then the mid 2000s. And then after that, my husband said, don't show it to any more of your friends until it's done. So I went with professional editors to read it instead of my long-suffering friends and relatives.
Nice. You know, this is a little bit off topic, but I listened to a podcast called Writing Excuses, which is all about writing genre fiction. I have no intention to ever do that, but one of the hosts is an author that I like a lot, and I finished all of his work. And I figured before he gets around to doing his next book, let's listen to the podcast as kind of like methadone.
Right.
And one of the things that strikes me over and over again is how long this process is and how long it can take for things to percolate and evolve and develop, and how much your first attempt at everything is supposed to suck and then evolves into this beautiful story.
Oh, yes, I think that's true.
Nice.
Sorry. I totally agree. Yeah, you have to, first drafts are usually really messy, and you just have to let them, you know, they say, oh, put it in a drawer for 6 months. That's the, you know, you have to do something like that. You have to stand back and, yes, maybe show it to a writing partner or a writing friend, but you need to let it sit, because it really does need to percolate, and it will be much better the more you think about it. Mm-hmm. So, but I do believe there are people, I'm sure, like Alexander McCall Smith, who does the Ladies' Number One Detective Agency books and so many other things. I think he just writes nonstop. I mean, this guy has such incredible productivity. He's amazing. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a long process.
Well, actually, one of the podcast hosts, if folks are listening, it's Brandon Sanderson. He's a popular fantasy author. He also is extremely prolific, but, you know, even a lot of his stuff has been sitting around for years. It's just he has like three things in a drawer while he's working on something else.
That's great. Maybe that's the key. I don't know.
All right. Well, like getting myself back on topic, you know, we talked about, you know, this idea that you wanted to go a little bit farther back in history. And one thing that I noticed is that this does span the entire history of kind of the state, right, of Saudi Arabia, the modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Obviously not the entire history of the people, but of it as a country from, you know, just before it's being established and actually going into the present and even like a little bit into the near future. Would you like to tell us about some of those, like some of the major historical points that these two characters, Fawzia and Salma, live through? With the caveat that I know that there's one thing that we, at least one thing that we can't go into without hitting spoilers.
Right. Well, yeah. Okay. I really, let me say why I thought this was such a fun thing to do for me as a writer. Mm-hmm. I think that when we learn about Saudi history, or any history of any Arab country, all we know is the politics and the oil, if it's an Arabian country, you know, if it's an oil country. Or, you know, it's just, there are so many sort of heavy, heavy topics that we study, but we never or rarely hear what it was like for women to live through these times. And I think it's kind of true of our own society, too. We're learning women's fiction is such a beautiful way to study history, you know. And I felt that I really wanted to write and sort of chronicle in a fictional form what it must have been like to live through some of these things. You know, there are so many books that people are just devouring, writing and devouring about World War II, still all these decades later, like The Nightingale. I don't know if you've read that one. It's just a fascinating story about two sisters in the French countryside who lived through World War II. And it's just an example of, you know, women just caught up in history. And I wanted to do the same thing in Arabia. And one of the main characters, the older woman, her name is Salma, she is loosely based on the legend of a real person. Now, mind you, I really fictionalized it, and I did note that it was extremely loosely based on her life. But she was the niece of a great tribal chieftain who actually fought in World War I with Lawrence of Arabia. So she would have known and seen Lawrence of Arabia herself, and she lived through all that, and she ended up in the city of Jeddah, just as in the story, and several of the key points in the story actually happened to this other person. And that's probably the anchor that drew me back to the World War I, because I wanted to imagine what her story must have really been like. You know, really, what would it be to be her? And how did she get from point A to point B? And along the way, she would have encountered things like the Armenian Genocide, the 1918 influenza epidemic that we all know as the Spanish flu, which, you know, killed millions of people around the world. But poor old Arabia, where there were no hospitals, very few doctors, very little knowledge of modern medicine, and people just, you know, died. And even today, when you meet really, really old people, they talk about Sanat al-Rahma, which is the year of mercy, and that is 1918. It's something that, you know, people still talked about for many, many years afterwards. Also, the founding of the kingdom, the consolidation of it by Abdulaziz, the first king, and the 1979 takeover of the Holy Mosque in Mecca. That's a big watershed for Saudi modern history, and it was so important, you know, on many levels. But there were many, many people who were caught in the mosque when that happened. And there's no female eyewitness account written of it. Now, there's a book out about it that's helped me a great deal to piece together what it must have been like to be an eyewitness. So those are some of the things. And then, of course, I did skip a big period, I would say, from about 1980 to pretty much the present day. I kind of just flew over that landscape because I kind of didn't want to stop the narrative. You know, I just wanted to come to the resolution of the epilogue. So I did not go on. That would have been a whole nother book to do, like 1979 to 2017.
You still could.
I know. Yes. But so those are some of the things that are in there, and there's more. I mean, there's the oil boom that was in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. I tried to capture kind of the zeitgeist and the atmosphere of what was going on at that time, all those times.
And that was also concurrent with the Lebanese Civil War, right?
Correct. Right. Oh, yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Because the young character is a young graduate from AUB, and you know, that AUB kept operating for a number of those years. I don't know if it actually ever shut down, but especially at the time when this character was there, they had graduation and they still kept going. Of course, no one knew how long the darn thing would go on and how serious it would get, of course.
Mm-hmm. So that was the American University of Beirut, right?
Right, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just for a shout out to the belly dancers in the area, I mean, listening to this, the Lebanese Civil War was actually a pretty big influence on American style belly dance because it sparked a big wave of Lebanese migration to the U.S. So my teacher's husband, for example, was in that wave. So an awful lot of like the Lebanese presence has a really direct impact on us.
Interesting.
Cool. All right. Now, you know, you did talk about wanting to present women's experiences of these historical events. And as you mentioned, pretty much all of the written history focuses on what men's experiences would have been, or kind of the, you know, big picture great movements in history rather than individual experience. So how do you capture women's experiences in a situation like that?
Well, you first of all, I had my anchor character. I knew that she existed. So I knew about her, and I just tried to imagine. I knew a little bit about her family, and what I knew had to happen to her based on the legend and how I wanted to, you know, make it more detailed. That's where I went from. I did a ton of research on pretty much every facet of her story. And that was also informed by the years when I was living in Saudi Arabia, interviewing women, learning what I could about, you know, desert life. I never spent time with the Bedouin in Saudi Arabia. I mean, of course, I sat in a tourist tent once and had visited a Bedouin family that was accepting a tourist bus. So we pulled up near Taif one day and had camel's milk, and, you know, it's only like 10 of us. But no, I did not spend years or months in the desert with the Bedouin in Saudi Arabia. But there's a lot that can be gained from research about their lives, from some of the most incredible writers like H.A.R. Dixon. I believe that those are his initials. He was born and raised among the Bedouin and wrote a huge book on them. He lived in Kuwait for many years. He was like a British minister there. And he and his wife were close to Arab of the Desert. And, you know, books like that are really great. I found a lot of travel literature was very useful. But as far as, you know, any novelist, at some point you have to make the leap and just do it in your own mind. You know what I mean? So, yes, and as much as I could, I just researched the heck out of it and asked people when I came across people who might know. I had the good fortune to go back to Saudi Arabia 3 times on assignment. And each time, I mean, after I came back full-time from Saudi Arabia, it was 1985, and I got to go back 3 times later, and as technology and the internet advanced, so much more became available, and I could communicate with people. So, like, I could email somebody that I'd met in one of those trips and ask, hey, how would you say this in the thus and such dialect? You know, what would the wording be? And I'd get an email back. So it was incredible to have the chance to go back and make those connections, and they helped me with my research as I got down the line.
Mm-hmm. All right. And, you know, and you mentioned, you know, your fascination with folk culture, and obviously there's just a ton of detail about that in this book, both in kind of creating this beautiful environment that everything happens in, but also in actually advancing the plot. Can you tell us about some of the aspects of folk culture that you chose to include?
Wow. Okay. Okay. Let's talk about dance, because I know a lot of folks, that's the most obvious one, because I know people are interested in dance probably on this call. So let me talk about that as one of the things that, you know, I felt that this was a mysterious thing I had to learn and explore while I was there. So I would interview people, write stories about it. And every time it just took me years to figure things out, and I'm still learning, honestly. But I made a list, I think 9 different types of dance, folk dance and party dancing are mentioned and described in the book. And from Dubki to party dancing of Khaliji women, Bedouin dancing, Armenian dancing, some of the traditions from Central and Northern Arabia. And I really wanted those to be in there to, you know, beef up the celebratory scenes so that people could imagine these people moving around. One of the things I really tried to do in this book was to have my female characters interacting with their environment and using all their senses, whether it would be, you know, like we do in the West. It's the style of writing that we do here in the West. And I wanted to try that in that environment and bring out how I experienced that culture, which is full of sensory overload almost. It's so, you know, the sights, the sounds, and the smells and everything. Also, storytelling is a key aspect of this book. The idea, when you live there, people are constantly telling stories. And yes, there has been a tradition of professional storytellers, and it's kind of as a form of entertainment, and it's kind of reviving now. I think it's a spin-off of all the popularity of storytelling happening in our own culture. But in the old days, people used to just sit around and tell stories, and there's so much humor in everyday life there. I don't think I'm a great comedian, so I don't know if I brought that out, but I have never laughed so hard. All the unusual stories that you would hear about life over there, which is understandable given the mix of people and the changing times, and it was just uproarious, a lot of the stuff that you would hear. So I tried to weave in storytelling and poetry, and poetry, of course, is the stuff of songs. So there are many, many little song lyric poems that I composed myself. I think there's one excerpt of an actual song lyric. All the rest of the song lyrics are my own creation. There's one long form of a Bedouin poem that is a huge impetus in the plot. And I have studied Arabic poetry in Arabic and desert poetry also in translation. It's called Nabati poetry, the modern spoken poetry. And I wanted to create something similar to that, in terms of complexity of metaphor and its images, and then the power and meaning of a poem like that. I also have women's weaving, which is I learned about from my friend Joy Tildren, who did a beautiful book on Hilden, rather, who did a beautiful book on Bedouin weaving of Saudi Arabia. And if you look at the cover of the book, the border is a pen and ink, you know, imagined border or pattern from one of the Bedouin weavings that the women do. So that's another thing. There's costume in there. I'm trying to think what other elements. Oh, I think that's a good start, I would say.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that I loved was the coffee circle.
Oh, yes.
Would you tell us about that?
Yes, very good. Thank you. So in that culture, hospitality is supreme. And the host should serve coffee to his guests. And we're talking about a male host to his male guests. And even out in the desert, you take the precious coffee beans and cardamom seeds and you grind them up with a mortar and pestle, and then you put them in the coffee pot with water and you set the coffee pot on the fire and you boil it. And then when it's ready, then it's poured and offered to the guests, and they drink it. And the actually coffee is almost, it looks like green tea. It's kind of a greenish orange color, and it smells heavily of cardamom. It's not sweet. It's a little bit bitter, but it's very refreshing, incredibly refreshing taste. Just a few beans, so it's not dark. And the reason there would only be a few beans is because the Bedouin were not wealthy people and they had to, you know, ration it. So that's what they would do. And it's a beautiful thing. You can find YouTubes of people doing the coffee ritual. And usually the coffee cups are little, small. They're almost like tiny handleless teacups, like little girls' teacups. That's the size they are. And they hold them in a stack and they pour them one by one and offer them off the top to the guest. And the women do it too, of course, but most of the time, you know, you see the iconic giving of hospitality is the males offering it to the male guests. And in houses then, in homes, in the city, in the villages, they echo that tradition as well. And in one of the towns where some of the chapters take place, which is the city of Oneza, an old oasis city in the middle of Arabia, the great homes would have a coffee circle in the men's salon, and the floor of which would be filled with desert sand from the Nafud. So they would have, in effect, their little desert coffee circle in their house.
All right. Well, a little bit ago, you know, you mentioned when you're talking about the humor, you mentioned about the mix of people and all the changes that were happening at that time. And I think Saudi Arabia especially, but even like the Middle East as a whole, sometimes gets presented to us in the West as this kind of monolith where everybody's the same. Everybody's an Arab, everybody's Muslim, everybody's the same ethnicity with the same views. But one of the things I loved about this book was that there was such a mix of different types of people. So would you like to tell us about some of the different groups of people that are in Saudi Arabia and have been in Saudi Arabia?
Right. Oh, wow. That's a huge topic. That would be a PhD thesis, but let me give you... So, yes, in fact, especially in the western part of Saudi Arabia, which is the region known as the Hejaz, it holds the two most holiest cities in Islam, Mecca and Medina. Those cities have attracted pilgrims from all over the Muslim world for many centuries. And as a result, people would come on the pilgrimage or on the... And they would stay. They might find a wife there. Their people did meet up on pilgrimage and on visits to the holy places, and they might settle in the area, and there might be a whole little mini community of people from their own home country. And as a result of that, you have mixed groups, all kinds of ethnicities in the holy cities. There are people from the Far East and from Africa, from basically all over. Javans are there. They call them Javanese. And people from Eastern Europe, people from, you know, Turkey, and, you know, all over the Arabian Gulf, certainly, Yemen, et cetera. And, you know, Africa and beyond. So I brought that mix in so that you could get a sense of that. It's interesting, these days I'm giving library talks up in Maine that are all about the incredible changes that are happening to Saudi women right now. And as a part of these talks, I have this PowerPoint, and I use a lot of photographs and some amazing YouTubes that are coming out that show all the different types of Saudi women. And the people in the audiences invariably say, I cannot believe all these different ethnicities are really Saudi women. I mean, to see images of it really proves it. And I'm finding that quite fascinating, and it's very eye-opening for people. Okay, in addition to that, I really am fascinated with this one group of people called the Soluba that we don't know. I think they've all but disappeared now in modern times, but they were sort of they were considered non-Arab tribe that lived among the desert Bedouin. And they were kind of, they had a symbiotic relationship with the more so-called noble Arab tribes. They worked as barbers. They rode donkeys, which the Arab tribes did not do. They did things like tell fortunes and trying to think what other... They were tinkers, that's right. And they would do things that the Arab tribes considered dishonorable, but they were also expert desert trackers. For instance, Abdulaziz, the first Saudi king, he had a private Soluba tracker that would help him when he wanted to go hunting. And they supposedly had knowledge of ancient secret wells deep down in the desert. Some people have speculated that they're like the remains of some ancient hunter-gatherer tribe, and that's very fun to imagine, but I'm not sure if that's even plausible given, you know, how populations over the centuries kind of get wiped out. I can't even imagine there could be a group of hunter-gatherers that would still be around in the early 20th century in Arabia, but it's fun to think about anyway. They all settled, and because they didn't have famous tribal names, I think they've kind of disappeared. I'm kind of sad about that because, I don't know, I find them absolutely fascinating. So I wrote some of them into the story, as you know. And was there another group? Oh, I also dealt with slavery and servitude, which unfortunately was, as it was in our country, was part of life there. And there were, you know, servants and slaves from African countries brought in. Yes, that was, and they're still there. I mean, there are some of the highest ranking families. You have all different colors and ethnicities. So the mixing has been going on for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that there was also a pretty big boom in kind of the oil heyday of guest workers.
Oh yes, that's another, aside from actual Saudis, during the oil boom and even now, there are many, many different types of foreigners living there. It's a mini United Nations, definitely. In any city in Saudi Arabia, it's quite unique. And one really fun thing about that is that because there are guest workers from all these different countries, inevitably these little restaurants pop up. And there might be a little hole in the wall, but you know you're getting the real good stuff because they have, you know, actual workers from the Philippines or Thailand or wherever it is, and you're going to get really good ethnic food. The ethnic food there is just really great.
All right. Now, one of the things that I thought played a big role in this book was some of the differences among people who were living a more like nomadic tribesperson life versus settled versus partway on the way to going settled. Can you tell us a little bit about how that plays out in Saudi Arabia or has in the past?
Great question. So, you know, 100 years ago, Saudi Arabia was a very poor country way before oil. Oil was discovered in 1938. So, and the country itself was not even founded officially until 1932. So back at the close of World War I, you had rural society, a lot of desert tribes, people living nomadically or semi-nomadically. And there were the great cities of Mecca and Medina and Jeddah on the west coast. And then the small cities like Riyadh, which is now the big capital. And then there were other oasis cities like Unayza and Bureida and Ha'il. And Al Jouf, going up, I'm going from south to north along the center of the kingdom, what's modern Saudi Arabia. And there were always these ancient little oasis cities because of trade. And also, when people were coming on pilgrimage over land, they would come down from Iraq or come across from east to west, and they would have to stop at these oasis places and move along to the next one. There are ancient overland pilgrimage routes. So there's long-distance trade. People would trade horses and dates and bring goods back and forth on camel and horseback. In fact, that's another group that I write a lot about, the Agheli long-distance traders, who were like, you know, international businessmen riding their ships of the desert to get from point A to point B. And some of them lived abroad for a long time and would come back. There was another group of traders that were called Jamamil, and they were just camel guys. They would come and sell their livestock on the edge of a town, and then they would turn around and go home. Whereas the Agheli's would actually go and live like in Bombay or Cairo or Baghdad for years, and they would learn about other places and other cultures and bring some of that back with them. And now, after oil, people, when the oil wealth started to flow in, the oil was really discovered in the eastern province, and the little city of Al-Khobar and Al-Damam became much more important, and an oil city called Dahran was established. And that was a magnet for young men who wanted to work and make some money, and they got educated, they learned business skills, and they raised themselves up. And a lot of talented young people were also drawn to Riyadh, which became the capital of Saudi Arabia. And so gradually, the oil wealth really started to flow in the 70s. And by that time, they had the money, the country had the money to really develop its roads, its hospital network, establish public schools, and those kind of things bring people, you know, to live in villages and cities.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, another thing that comes up in the book pretty often is this idea of the different societal expectations that women face when they're in different contexts. And we see a lot of this in all of our characters. So with Fawzia, she's got very different requirements for how she dresses, how she acts, who she can socialize with when she's in Beirut at college, when she's at home in Jeddah, when she's away in the mountains. And I don't know if I should get into anything that Salma's specific to Salma, because that might get into spoilers.
I think for, let's stick to the modern day character, you know, the younger one, for sure. I mean, I think when you go off to college, wherever you are, you suddenly live in a whole different culture than your culture at home. And for any someone from a traditional culture like Saudi Arabia going to the States or Lebanon or Egypt, you have to, your expectations around you are changed. And in Fawzia's case, her family is very forward-looking, and they've, you know, her parents were both educated in Egypt, and they certainly did not expect her to, you know, they were kind of a international family, pretty cosmopolitan anyway. So she was not the type that was staying home all the time in any case in her own town. But yes, she did live the student life. And the thing that she did, and this is like in the first chapter of the book, so I don't think that this is really a spoiler, but she did the forbidden thing of dating a young man. You're not supposed to date if you're a Saudi girl. Or even an Arab girl, that's such a bad thing to be known to be dating someone in that society, although it's so commonly done. You just don't want to be seen. You just have to keep it really quiet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is very common, even today in Saudi Arabia, the young people are meeting up on social media. That's what they're doing now. Virtually, they talk, or they can, you know, they get to know each other, and they might meet a couple of times secretly, and then they arrange it so it looks like it's a proper arranged marriage. They used to use matchmakers, but the matchmakers have kind of gone out of business now because the young people have taken it into their own hands with WhatsApp and Snapchat and all that stuff. But the point is, you don't want to be caught doing something that your family's not expecting you to do. And that's the issue with Fawzia. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, getting back to this, you know, monolith stereotype, I think that in kind of the narratives that we get here in the West, there's this idea that Muslim women, and especially Saudi women, are these, you know, oppressed, passive, resigned victims, and they just grind through this horrible existence. But, you know, in this book, we see both Fawzia and Salma finding ways to live their own lives. And I know that, you know, you have Saudi friends, and you've been in contact with actual people. You know, what are some of the ways that Saudi women exert their agency while still working in the system they live in?
Well, I call it their wondrous workaround. It's like there's this whole separate world where the women are able to operate. Because you think, you know, if they're not allowed to do something with men, then they just do it with themselves in terms of like setting up a business. Or one of the most fascinating things, and I'm talking about this a lot these days in my library talks, is they did the most amazing thing back in the 60s, sort of the leading women in society. They set up a network of philanthropies and charities. And you think, well, what's so interesting about that? But what it did was it got women out of their houses to come to a central neutral place to meet women from all different families. So it's not just cousins or whatever. It's a little bit more random. So they're formed networking. And what they did was they worked together to do good works, to set up like literacy training for adults or daycare for mentally challenged children or all kinds of, you know, charitable giving for the needy. And they formed committees. They learned how to form an organization, to have officer elections, and how to do a project. These groups got bigger and bigger, and they spread all over Saudi Arabia. And this is one way that women, and no men are allowed inside the buildings. So it's completely run by women, and really for the interests of women and families. And I'm not saying that's all they did. A lot of them started their own businesses, and they got educated, might work in their family business if their father was fine with that. They did all kinds of things. And then, of course, education is basically most of the time segregated between men and women. So that means you have to have a whole education infrastructure that's run by and administered by women. So that's a lot of jobs and a lot of women working together. So, you know, they worked around it, basically.
Mm-hmm. All right. And, you know, another thing that I think was a major piece of what happens in the book is that you see both of these characters, the younger woman and the older, in this balancing act between what it is that they want and how that's going to affect their family's honor and reputation. Mm-hmm. And then we also see several male characters, you know, forcing to weigh their responsibility to their family's honor against the happiness of the women in their lives. And we see different people come up with very different conclusions. Can you tell us more about how honor fits into Saudi culture and whether that's different for men versus women, how it's changed over time, and, you know, how similar or different it is from the way that it plays out or has played out in Western culture?
Oh, okay.
I know this is huge. We could probably do a whole episode on this.
That's right. And what I would say is any person who is a member of a family, a traditional family, especially a tribal family, and you know you're a tribal family if your last name is a tribal last name. So you would be like Nadira Jamal al-Hijazi, if Hijazi was actually a tribe, which it's not. Al-Otaibi, for instance, the Otaiba tribe. So you'd say, oh, I'm from the Otaiba tribe. And so everyone in that Otaiba tribe, which could be thousands of people, they all share that brand, okay? If you do something really wrong in public, that reflects badly on all of them. And that doesn't matter if you are man or a woman, okay? You have to, everyone, each person, man or woman, has to uphold the good name of their family and especially their tribe. Women are more risky in terms, they have more to lose in terms of the good name of the family because, you know, they can, they're getting into trouble is much more serious if it gets public, the kind of things that women get in trouble for, you know, romantic problems, et cetera, et cetera. And it's, you know, whatever is more gossipy, that's much more damaging. So you have, they have to be aware of how the family name is affected. Unfortunately, in the power structure, normally the women have less power. So they have more vulnerability because they have less power, yet they are, they represent, they hold up more of the honor on their shoulders at the same time. It's a tough bargain. However, many people don't have those big tribal names. You know, it's not like the whole, because it's a city of towns, it's a country of towns, cities, and yes, big tribal families that settled there. Through time, I think it's still an issue, especially with social media. You know, you can really get into trouble in a big way with millions of people knowing about it rather than just a couple hundred, right?
It facilitates the gossip.
Yes, and you can, and this is why, like, Saudi singers, female singers, usually have a stage name, much like Umm Kulthum is a stage name or Fairuz, but Saudi women too have stage names so that they aren't flashing their tribal name around to the horror of the more conservative males in their extended family, who really would not want to have an entertainer in their family. And that's true of any Arab family, I would say. You know, a lot of most Arab families in all over would not be happy having a female entertainer in their family. It's just, that's true in many societies. It's not just Arab society. I just want to point that out. But
can I jump in there for a second?
Pardon me? Yeah.
I just want to jump in there for a second. You know, for folks who are not aware of this, this was very, very, very true in the West, you know, even into like the early 20th mm-hmm. century. So my mom, when she was a kid and she wanted to take up ballet in like 1960, her mother was scandalized because she still thought of, you know, was like running off to join the circus. Because her mom was a little older. So, right. So, you know, at that point, ballet was kind of respected. And that was when it was around the time when families started sending their little girls to take ballet just because mm-hmm. it was good for them, supposedly. But you know, there was a very strong, oh no, you know, up until, I want to say like the 1910s, ballet was not at all respectable. Being an actress was very disrespectable.
Right.
Yeah. So like this is not just a like different cultures thing. This was like the norm for most of
right.
time in most places.
Exactly. Yep.
Sorry.
I would
Please
say
continue.
the other thing to talk about honor is, much like in our society, in the old West, there was kind of an honor among the cowboys. A code of honor, things that you would and would not do. And I think among the desert Arabs, the Bedouin, there is also a code of honor that is not always to the disadvantage of women. For instance, this practice of giving people refuge who seek your help. And if someone seeks refuge and is in your tent, you must protect them no matter what. You have the right to keep anyone at bay who tries to harm them. And that, you know, that plays out. That's an earlier, it's a very old tradition. And that's part of the whole honor thing too, because, and then the honor of giving hospitality. You must give hospitality. It's a great duty and an honor for someone to do that. Have I gone off on too big of a tangent there?
No, I love it.
Okay.
All right. And, you know, one of my favorite things that keeps coming up in the book is, you know, we hear characters ask over and over again, why are there so many songs and poems about forbidden and secret love? And, you know, I was thinking about this because I noticed it 3 or 4 times. So that means it probably happened, you know, 6 or 7 times at least. And, you know, forbidden love is this popular theme in all of the arts all over the world. And it keeps being popular, right? You know, we think mm-hmm. back to Romeo and Juliet, and then Taylor Swift did a Romeo and Juliet themed song like 10 years ago. So, you know, given that how love fits into society keeps changing in different times and places, why do you think it's so fascinating, this forbidden love, to all of us, to everybody, regardless of how we are and aren't allowed to act on it in
right.
our own lives?
Oh, wow. Good. Well, phew. Good question. Heavy duty. You know, it's, you know, the human heart cannot be tamed, I guess. And I think that the way we're socialized, there are limits to what you should do, you know, in your relationships, and there's a limit of propriety and what society expects. And these characters in the book, they find themselves in situations that they were never prepared for, and they feel totally alone. And they were, you know, they're both young girls, and it's like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do now? They have no one really to confide in. And yet they suddenly notice, well, you know, I'm supposed to be doing this, but how come the poetry says all this? You know, it's a huge contradiction. And I think it's especially interesting in the Arab world where, you know, women are really not supposed to date. And yet there is this whole frequency of music and poetry and singing that has to do with all the many myriad facets of all kinds of love, you know. It's like it all exists in that one wavelength, and everyone else, the rest of life is just ignoring it. It's a funny contradiction, I think. And that's why I think I brought it out in the story, because these two, the characters are just kind of lost because they can't really process it. You know, it's sort of a big disconnect in their own lives.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I felt like was just a beautiful perspective, even though it's one that I feel really lucky to have never held for my own life, is this idea of love as something that's potentially dangerous.
Right.
But something that you can cherish the experience of, even if you know it's not going anywhere and never can. I'm trying to think of what the phrase was. It was like, for a while your heart blossomed.
Oh, like the, you know, the flowers in the desert, blooming in the desert, mm-hmm. the spring rain or something like that.
Right. And so it's the fact that your heart opened up at all.
Oh,
it's
right.
It's a huge
yes,
thing for
yes.
your life, and is this wonderful experience that you'll always have, even if you're going to lose this thing that it opened for.
Right. It's kind of sad, isn't it? That was right. There are poems, you know, some of the poems I've read in Arabic, but mostly in translation, these Bedouin poems that are just so extraordinary, where I remember one in particular where the guy met a girl at some big tribal meetup, right? And they had a brief romance, who, you know, very innocent, I'm sure. And I think the only time he ever sees her again is across a valley once, like 10 years later. And he's still thinking about her and writing poetry about her.
Mm-hmm.
So they do. Someone once told me, I heard there's no word in Arabic for love. And I just was dying laughing, because that's like saying there is no word for snow in Eskimo, right? And the poetry is so full of all permutations of attraction and, you know, unrequited love and just, you know, memory, the nostalgia of one time meeting somebody, you know, at a desert encampment 30 years ago. And it's just a lot of amazing poetry about the human condition and fondness between two humans. So, and I don't know, I think that the you can think about the richness of Arabic poetry. It's something that we can hardly explore when we're not deep in the language itself. And even then, a lot of the poetry is very difficult to understand. But it's a really, really colorful and beautiful world that I tried to bring out. I don't know if you can, the cover of the book, for instance, was done by a Boston area book cover designer named Lewis Rowe. He works for Beacon Press, which only does nonfiction, so he was available to freelance and do the cover for me. And I just said, I want bright colors. The first round came through with some of the characters cut with their head covered, wearing black. And I just emailed Lewis, no head covers, no black outfits. You know, it's like I'm trying to bring out the color of the culture. So that is my goal with that cover anyway, and I'm really happy with the way it came out. Anyway, how did I get onto that? I don't know. Steer me back, Nadira.
That we were in a good place. All right.
Okay.
Now, we touched on this a little bit already, but you know, another one of the big themes in the book is this idea of passing the story down, both your story and, you know, the stories that you encounter to kind of get them forward into the future.
Right.
And obviously, this is something with a really universal appeal. I don't think it's, you know, specifically a Saudi or Arab thing at all. I think we can all relate to that. But
sure.
Can we talk more about the significance of storytelling in Saudi culture? You know, you already talked about there being some professional storytellers. Has that traditionally been a women's thing, an every gender thing?
Every gender thing. Yep. Mm-hmm. Both. Yep. But because, you know, a lot of times men and women would be separate at events, you would have people who, the women would tell stories to women and the men would tell to men. But most of the time when you're with your family, it's all mixed up anyway. So, you know, your uncle might tell a story to everyone. It's just when there are strangers around that you have to divide up between men and women. So, yeah, it's there. And there's a movement to record folk tales and elders' stories. But I think that something I was trying to say that they need. I feel there's so much rich history, personal history, that may have been lost because the older generations passed on just as all that oil wealth came in, and everyone was busy getting their doctorate and becoming teachers and chemists rather than listening, getting some of these old stories down on paper or at least recording them. So I'm hoping more people have done this. I mean, I've heard some really interesting tales about how women used to live. One of my all-time favorite books where you get a sense of all that and the way it used to be is this fascinating memoir called At the Drop of a Veil by a woman named Marianne Alireza, who married a Saudi in the 40s and went out to live in Jeddah. And she homeschooled her kids out there, and she gathered so many hilarious anecdotes of her own experiences and those of other people. I can't recommend that book enough. It is absolutely glorious. If you want more of the culture of what it was like in the 40s, and she pulled together a lot of anecdotes. But there's a woman named, I believe it's Hend Baghafar. She has collected a lot of folk tales, but all of this stuff, her work is all in Arabic right now, so it's inaccessible to English readers. I think we need more true Saudi women's memoir so that we can truly understand what their world is like. And my favorite one right now is the fabulous book called Daring to Drive, written by Manal Asharif, who is known as a Saudi women's and women driving activist. It came out last year, and it's an extraordinary book that details her childhood in Mecca. She was born into a poor family. This is not a privileged person, and she's brilliant in how she managed to triumph. And that is an exploration in how young women manage to negotiate the modern society in Saudi up until the changes that are happening now. So I just can't recommend that book enough either. Even Oprah recommended it, and I think that that was a good call. I my book groups have read it. They love it. And everyone I've talked to who has read that has learned so much. That's a really good one. There is a great movement to kind of revive and preserve all aspects of Saudi women's heritage in Saudi Arabia right now. So that's kind of exciting. And, oh, the other thing I wanted to mention recently, a bunch of women put on a play, and I think it was in Arabic. And the premise of this play was three fictional characters of women from Saudi history all telling their story to each other on the site of Eve's tomb in Jeddah, which is I mentioned in the book. And I just thought that was a fabulous idea for a play. So there's stuff happening back there, definitely.
Excellent. Well, I think that's about everything that I have for my major questions. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that I didn't ask you about?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow. I think mostly, you know, the culture is so colorful, and I just wanted to pull people in and just like almost take them by the hand and just take them on this journey through the eyes of a first-person narrator. I mean, that's one way you bring a reader, you know, close in. And I used, for my copy editor, I was able to work with the extremely wonderful Marsha Links Quayle, who is very involved in editing translated works from Arabic. Mm-hmm. She looked at my manuscript. She was like the last editor that went through it. And I had many, many Arabic terms in there. And she said, no, you've got to get rid of like 99% of these. Because she said, if you leave those in there, you create such a distance between you and the reader. Mm. And she suggested ways to take out all that Arabic. And I so agree. She said, you're trying to hold your reader close here. And if you have those Arabic words, you're just going to alienate them, so don't. So, I mean, some people still have trouble, I know, with the foreign terms, but I cut out most of them. And I have put up, by the way, a PDF of all the foreign terms on my website if anyone's interested, khardycampbell.com.
Great.
But
and
anyway,
where can people...
Go ahead.
Where
can
people
get
find
it?
Your book? Mm-hmm.
Yes, Amazon. And any bookstore can get it. If you want to patronize your local bookstore, which I highly recommend, they can order it not through Amazon, but there's a whole other channel. Barnes & Noble has it online. And you can get it a Kindle or any other ebook platform via, you've got the link. I think you're going to put the link up. It's like called bookstoread.com. So you can get it on your Apple, your iBook, or whatever ebook platform you like.
If people want more from you, what are their options for that?
To get in touch with me, you mean?
To get in touch with you, to learn more from you.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I am teaching two upcoming workshops in, actually three, but two upcoming workshops in the folk dances of women of the Gulf. I'm going to be teaching up in Montreal in the first weekend of June for Sanat Dance. And I think you're going to put the link of that up on your website. And then on July, is it 7th and 8th? I will be with the Origins Folk Dance Group and Rock On Dance Studio up in Vermont, teaching a class in Khaliji or Gulf folk dance. Yes, that's the 7th and 8th of July. And you can find out about that on Nadira is going to put up the link for that.
Yep, those will all be in the show notes.
Oh, thank you. And I'm also, if you are in Maine on May 12th, I'm going to do a book talk with Arabic music at Gulf of Maine Books in Brunswick, Maine. So stop by. There's a Facebook event about it. If you want to find my author page, you can find it there. But thank you for having me, Nadira. But we need questions. Are there any questions out there?
We are definitely going to take some questions. But first, I also wanted to ask you about the Arabic music retreat.
Can you
tell us about what that is, how it came about, how folks can participate?
Yes, this upcoming was our 22nd annual Arabic music retreat, August 4 to 11. It will be at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley. That's Western Massachusetts. A group of us founded this retreat back in 1997. Our executive director is Simon Shaheen. Our associate director is Dr. A.J. Rossi of UCLA, and I'm the administrative director. And we have a master-level faculty, many of whom return year after year, and we teach classical and folkloric Arabic music every year with the English language curriculum to musicians, students, composers, conductors, academics, all kinds of people, young to retired, and it's a wonderful, very intense week-long experience. If you're interested in learning more about it, our website is arabicmusicretreat.org. It's based loosely on the idea of how chamber music camps work. So from 9 a.m. till the evening, 10 o'clock or so, you're just going nonstop, whether it's lectures, small group practice, private lessons, and big orchestra. We have open mics, and it's a nonstop intensive experience. We teach everything from voice, oud, qanun, violin, nai, percussion, and cello, things like that. I think I got them all. Yes, I did. And it's really quite an experience. We usually have about 80 students, and by the end, we're all like one big family. You can imagine, and we put on a couple concerts.
And what kind of experience level is recommended going in?
We recommend if you should have some musical background. We do not like cater to beginners. If you are a good singer, so if you're interested in getting into Arabic music and you can sing, carry a tune and all, and you've had some choral experience, you could enter that way. Also, if you play percussion, that's another good way for a beginner to come in, like if you can play a few rhythms. And then you get exposed to all the different, the theory and some of the forms of Arabic music, and you start to learn repertoire. But if you play an instrument, even a Western-influenced instrument, if you're a violinist, Or if you're a guitar player who wants to learn oud, it's kind and a flute player who wants to learn nai, you can transition pretty quickly, and you would be able to attend and participate if you can, you know music theory, you know how to read music notation, you can jump in. If you learn by ear, you can also participate, although it's a little bit more challenging.
And my understanding is the concerts are open to the public, right? So if
yes,
you just want to come and listen.
That's right. They are free and open to the public.
Oh, I did not know they were free. Ooh.
Yes.
You nice.
Should come out. And there's an all-night party afterwards, so it's really quite something. So it would be Friday the 10th of August. But check our website again for more details on that.
Great. All right. Well, let's move on to the question and answer section. So if there's anybody who's on the call who wants to ask a question, if you are listening on the webcast only and you don't have your phone or mic and speakers, you can use the question box on the right. So the icon for that looks like a little square question bubble, like from a cartoon with three little dots in it. And if you are on the phone or Skype, you can press ** to unmute yourself. We would love to hear from you so you can ask questions, share your favorite takeaway. Go for it.
Is there anyone out there?
We
went on for a long time.
Well, I always like to say this is the part where everybody waits for somebody else to ask something first. Nobody wants to be the first one. All
hey,
right. Last call, folks. All right. Well, maybe we should wait for folks to read the book and then they can come back to you with questions. So we do have a private Facebook group for the clubhouse. Kay, I think you're in there.
I don't think so. Please
add
me,
though. Maybe
we
need to invite you. All right. Well, folks, if you have more questions, either after listening to the recording, if they occur to you later, or if you've read the book, we would love to hear from you. The clubhouse Facebook group is a great place to do that. And I'll be sending out an email shortly with an invitation. So for anybody who's not in there, we'll send you a direct link. This is a private group, just to make sure that we keep it in community. So there is always a delay for approving that. So it can take me a couple days to get that. So don't worry if you can't post right away. In that email, I'll also include a link to the call recording, as well as a link to the book and to the resources that Kay has mentioned on the call so far, so that you can find those easily. We've also got our feedback survey. So if you know of any topics or speakers or any way that I can improve the clubhouse, I would love to hear from you. Our next call is going to be on Wednesday, May 23rd. We've got Zahra Zuhair returning, and she is going to be talking about letting the genie out of the bottle. So how to unleash your creative genius. And thank you so much, Kay. This was so geektacular. I loved it.
No, thanks for having me back. And I really appreciate the opportunity. And your questions are really good.
Thank you.
And you did a great job researching the book, and it just makes me, I'm just so pleased and honored and very grateful for the opportunity. So
well,
best of
you.
Luck. I love the sound of the next session. I think I'm going to be tuning in.
Excellent.
Anyway,
and
thanks a million.
My pleasure. And again, for folks who are listening, the book is really great. I wouldn't say that I'm a snob, but I read a lot, and there are a lot of books that grab me and a lot of books that don't. And this one really did grab me. You know, it was something that, it was this call that prompted me to read it. But if somebody had handed it to me and said, read this, and I just sat down with it, like I was grabbed in the first couple of pages. So it's a beautiful story. It has a tremendous amount of detail if you want to pick up some of the flavor of the culture. But it's also just like a lovely story of two women living their lives, connecting with each other. So if you enjoy like multi-generational fiction, I think you're going to love it. So pick it up. All
Thanks,
right.
Nadira.
My pleasure. And the last thing I always want to say to everybody is that this is the come on in kind of clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody who would like to join us, you can invite them at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Thanks, Lydia. Good night. Take care. Bye now.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.